The following is a presentation of Stewed Productions.
Hey guys, Josh here, getting ready to have my conversation with Dr. Lewis Marcos of Houston Baptist University, talking about all things literary, Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and how all that relates to beer and all the goodness of life. And it's a fantastic conversation. I can't wait for you guys to hear Lou speak. He's fantastically brilliant and a joy to listen to. That's joy. That's probably the best way to express listening to Dr. Lewis Marcos. But if you like this show and appreciate this episode, we have a Patreon page. As little as $1 an episode, you can help support Interbrews. Interbrews.com/Patreon or Patreon.com/Interbrews. And coming up on the next episode, there is information on the exclusive episode coming up. There are exclusive episodes over 20 exclusive episodes, by the way. So it's not just supporting the podcast. You get a little something in return. And part of that exclusivity is a free offer exclusive only to Patreon supporters. So that's coming up in the next episode, episode 246, and that attached episode for patrons only. You get some free stuff, and it's going to be awesome. So go on over to Patreon, help support the podcast, and get a little free awesomeness, Houston cider awesomeness. How about that? Okay. Only for patrons, though. And every little bit helps, gets us towards video and all the good stuff. Thank you so much for supporting. Get out there and enjoy Houston craft beer, craft cider. Just enjoy Houston. Weather's awesome out there. And tell a friend about the podcast. If you can't help support monetarily, support in spirit with telling a friend. Appreciate it. Now on to the conversation with Dr. Lewis Marcos.
This is Interbrews.
All right, everybody. Welcome to Interbrews. I am super duper excited to welcome in this next guest. It's a little departure from the norm. We're not at a brewery today. Don't worry, we'll be back at one soon. Actually, tomorrow, Lou, we're going to be at Houston Cider Company, so we're not completely beer.
Cool.
So, sometimes you got to love them apples because
hard cider. There we go. That's
yeah,
a good thing these days.
It is. It's so anyway. That voice you hear is Dr. Lewis Marcos. He is a professor at Houston Baptist University, and as you will hear, well, he's going to tell us a lot about all kinds of things, but one of the most fascinating people I've ever heard on a podcast. And I first heard you, Lou, on the Naked Bible podcast with Dr. Michael Heiser, and you guys were talking about Tolkien and kind of the big overarching story, narrative that we all find ourselves in life. And I've listened to that episode literally 3 times.
Oh, wow.
And
great.
I've not done that. I don't think I've ever done that I'll listen to podcasts all the time. Like I just,
we did a second podcast on Milton's Paradise Lost.
Yes.
If you look for it.
No, yeah. I've listened to that one too. It's great. And you were mentioning before we started recording, you're going to be on again in January.
I've got a new book coming out called The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek and Roman Mythology Through Christian Eyes. And again, what can we learn from Greek mythology? I don't know if you see this, Josh, but you know, a lot of times preachers will use like an ancient Greek myth as a sermon illustration. But so often I find, and I'm not teasing, I mean, you know, we've got to really respect preachers because, you know, Josh, I do a lot of speaking, okay? But it's not like every time I speak, I give a brand new speech I've never given before, right? Now, I'm better than most. A lot of professional speakers have 3 speeches that they rotate forever. I've put together about 50, but still, you know, within those 50, I give them all a bunch of times. But a preacher has to come up with a brand new sermon every single Sunday. And they're only allowed to speak about the Bible, you know, especially if it's a good Baptist like me.
Yeah. Right?
And you know what happens, Josh, if I'm a Baptist preacher and I give the same sermon that I gave 10 years ago, some elder is going to say, "Hey, Lou, that's a great sermon, just as good as it was 10 years ago." Right? So anyway, the point was that a lot of times preachers use an illustration from, say, mythology, but they really don't know the myth. They just bought a book of sermon quotes that they're quoting. Okay, what I'm saying is I don't want to tease them because it's a very difficult job. But my point is that what I believe is that for Christians specifically, Greek mythology is just not a cute story. We can actually learn real wisdom from it, real goodness, truth, and beauty that all truth is God's truth, and we can actually learn from that. I know, of course, as a Christian, I've got the Bible as my measuring rod, right? I can test it against something.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's not something I'm doing just like a joke. I'm doing it because I'm trying to find wisdom and gather the wisdom of all people. Because, you know, I don't know about you, Josh, but it used to bother me. It's like, so you're telling me before Jesus came, God ignored 99% of the world and only talked to the Jews? Well, he only talked to the Jews directly, but through all the other people, he spoke to them in their yearnings and their desires. Maybe it was God who taught the Egyptians how to make beer. What do you think, Josh? Is that what you learned? My understanding is the Egyptians invented it. Is that what you discovered? What did you discover?
They were early on. Could have been the Sumerians, but it was
that
region for sure. And we do have evidence. And I've even, I know you know who Dr. Hugh Ross is. I messaged him a while back to ask, and he said there's even evidence that goes back even earlier than that of cooked grains and that sort of thing. Because you have to think, like, they couldn't keep bread around, and bread goes bad pretty quick. But you need to sustain yourself through the lean times and through the off seasons and all that kind of stuff. So the way to keep bread was to make it into liquid bread, which is beer.
Oh, that's good. I didn't think about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember, Josh, it's not Greek mythology, but the Bible that gives us the verse, wine that gladdens the heart.
Yes.
I used to think, oh, that must be in Homer somewhere, but it's actually in the Bible, right?
Yes.
So that, you know, in other words, we can learn things of value from these ancient pagan people, Greece, Rome, the Norse, all these different people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about it is that as a Christian, we should be actually freer to access that wisdom because we have that touchstone, that measure that we can measure things against.
Okay.
And again, we need to learn discernment. I mean, one of the things that you're doing with your program, Josh, is how do you learn a proper use of alcohol, right? What is a proper use of alcohol? Whether it's beer or wine, what's a proper use? And I teach it at a Baptist school. I actually don't drink. I'm not against drinking. But I teach it at a Baptist school, and when I try to explain it to my students, I'll say, okay, how do you know you're making a proper use of alcohol, whether it's beer or wine? And I think it's a rather simple thing. If your use of the alcohol is enhancing fellowship,
mm-hmm.
if it's enhancing your joy and bringing you closer to your family and friends, it's probably a proper use.
Yeah.
But if your drinking is isolating you from other people, you find yourself alone in the smoky bar or whatever, and drinking not to enhance your joy, but to deaden your pain,
mm-hmm.
then you could start realizing there's a problem. Because again, you know, God makes these things. These things are good, but how do we use them? It's just like mythology. Or it's, you know, I mean, if I was reading Greek mythology to find spells to control my friends, then I'm making a bad use of mythology, right?
Yes.
But if I'm using mythology to come closer to those big questions, who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? If I'm trying to get deeper into the truth, then that's a good use of it. And we need to understand that most of the things in our world are neutral, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are very few things that are just evil. And even those things are, like, for instance, okay, pornography is bad, but the reason pornography is bad is because it's a misuse of nudity,
yeah.
right? There's a good kind of nudity in great art that enhances the human form, that enhances particularly female beauty. That's the proper use. So pornography itself is a misuse
mm-hmm.
of nudity.
Yeah.
Right? And just like drunkenness is a misuse of alcohol.
Well, and I
think it's important.
I would take it even a step further. Like, I've heard the apologetic argument from beauty, where that you look at the beauty of this world, and why would it be this way unless there's a great mind that appreciates beauty behind it? And there is the visual for sure. And you can touch on the beauty of literature and the stories that we hear. But I think it's even a step further when you look at the reason there's a food network or a cooking channel, because it's beautiful to look at these dishes, and then you taste them and you eat them with somebody that you love, appreciate being around, have those great conversations, pair it with a delicious beer, glass of wine that further enhances it. It's almost like a symphony of flavor. And I think when we drink beer cheaply, I mean, granted, after I get done mowing the yard, there is nothing more refreshing than a light beer, or, you know, like a Gose that has a little bit of tartness to it. And it's only like 3%, and it's just, it hits the spot. It just literally, when you, the term hit the, there's like, God put a right. place inside of us, like post mowing. And I talk a lot about yard care on the show. I don't know why I talk about my flowers are looking great, by the way, Lou. There's just something to it. And when we, there's definitely a cheapening, when it's not, you know, the more you learn about something, the more you can appreciate it. And beer is very much, I see beer that way, because to know the people that brewed it, to know where the ingredients came from. I mean, you're talking about things that were grown, you know, half a world away from each other. The water that comes from the water table that brings flavor and the yeast and all that type of, it is really a beautiful, remarkable thing. And that, I think that was the biggest problem before the craft beer movement really got started, was that beer got cheapened in its approach, right. you know, dramatically. And so it became something that, when I was a kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, stay away from, is what I was told.
Yeah, well, it lost its human connection. Mm-hmm. I've got a very good friend, older friend, who's a real wine connoisseur. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize, he said that, you know, everything determined not just by the grape, but by the soil. I think terroir, is the French word he used. And everything that's in that soil, even the droppings of certain animals, mm-hmm. in a way finds its way into the wine. So that the wine is actually linked to the earth, mm-hmm. to a family that's been tending that earth. And let me tell you something, and this may have come up on your show, but I only learned this several years ago, and it was actually from this man who's a connoisseur. Do you know that Thomas Jefferson was a wine connoisseur, mm-hmm. that tried to bring wine to America and you know, bring it in the fullness that you're talking about beer. Mm-hmm. And why did he do that? He wanted to do that particularly because he saw so many Americans being destroyed by hard liquor, mm-hmm. by gin and vodka that's drunk quickly to get drunk. And so he, in other words, the way he was going to deal with the destructive effect of hard liquor was not to have a temperance movement like we did in the late 19th century.
Right.
His was, let's substitute that with something good, something human, something almost Eucharistic, right? That's what you were describing earlier, Josh, was very Eucharistic. It's part of the table. It's part of everything. And you know that, you know, and this is something, again, that I talked to my fellow Baptists, that you need to understand that in the day of Jesus and the days of the Greeks and Romans, there were no hard liquors. Mm-hmm. And anyway, when they drank their wine, they usually drank it 3-1, watered it down with 3 cups of water to 1 cup of wine. And what really generally turns people into alcoholics is hard liquor that's drunk one shot after another. And again, I didn't realize this. You know who invented hard liquors? It was actually invented by the Muslims, which is funny because they're not supposed to drink. But it was invented by the Moors. Those were the African Muslims that were controlling Spain. Yeah. And they were trying to create a better perfume, and they ended up creating distilled liquor. Because both vodka and perfume is a process where you are distilling or getting the essence of something out of it. Now, you know, you could also be a connoisseur of Jack Daniels, but you got to be a little bit more careful, right?
Yeah, it's a different approach, you know, for sure.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You got to be careful because it will hit you so quickly, right? Mm-hmm. But again, if you haven't looked this up, Josh, you really need to look this up. There's a famous British artist from the 18th century named Hogarth, H-O-G-A-R-T-H. And if you look him up online, Hogarth was a painter, but he's one of those people that made prints or etchings, right, where you like get a copper plate, mm-hmm. and you cut it up, and then you can print at it. So he was a printer. And he printed 2 prints called Beer, let me get this right, Beer Alley and Gin Lane. Right? And in Beer Alley, you've got these heavy, jolly-looking people looking very German. They've got their children around them. They're by the hearth. And you just see they're just like something out of Charles Dickens. Mm. But then Gin Lane is a bunch of people on the street looking like skeletons. They're you know, beggars on the curb. He's trying to talk about this distinction between a proper use and an improper use. What is it that enhances fellowship and enhances joy, all of us together, whether that's people at the wedding at Cana of Galilee, or whether it's a bunch of Texans doing boot scooting and having a couple of things of beer, together, being drawn together into family fellowship. And I'll tell you, one of the things we're losing is that family fellowship. Now, it's not quite as bad in America as it is other places, but less and less families, Josh, actually eat dinner together. They all come home at different times. They pull stuff out of the refrigerator. We've lost that sense of sitting down as a family and enjoying things communally and even kind of eucharistically. And I mean, you know that they discovered that the French have less trouble with heart disease, and a lot of them linked it to the wine, and a lot of them did link it to the tannins in the wine. And I think there's probably some truth to that. Mm-hmm. But I also think part of it is the kind of person that can just literally drink one or two glasses of wine with dinner and that's it. Mm-hmm. It's not only a person that has moderation and self-control, but those are the kind of people that usually eat dinner slowly with their family, thankful and grateful. They are, it's exactly what you described, where they are, all of their senses are together, so that there's nothing worse than Americans watching TV while they eat. But one of the things I started instituting with my kids is I would put on some classical music in the background while we ate, because that was enhancing our enjoyment of the taste and the flavor and the sound and the closeness. And we really, really need this. You know, our society is just falling apart. There's no more fellowship, except families don't even eat together. They eat on the run. That's terrible.
Yeah, I would say if one good thing has come from all of this COVID lockdown is that it's forced us to do more of that, more of the family together meals and things like that. And so it's, you know, my work schedule has been at night for a long time. And so during the summers, I have a lot of time during the day with my girls, but then, you know, during the fall, when they're in school, I see them for a few minutes before I run out the door as they're coming in.
Right.
But on the weekends, you know, we turn off the TVs. Maybe we'll watch a movie one of the nights, but, it's through this whole COVID thing, it's been fun and really rewarding just to sit down and get to know my wife and my kids and on a whole nother level. And I hope that's happening with a lot of people.
You know, what's crazy about this, I'll tell you what's crazy about this is that, you know, as from an American point of view, especially as conservative Christians, we look at the French and say they're so liberal. And in one sense, of course, they are very liberal. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, they're often more truly conservative and traditional than we are, because they do spend time with their family. And part of the problem is that, you know, our roots in America are very strongly, you know, sort of Germanic and Dutch roots, and that's really good. But unfortunately, those are countries where they have what's called the Protestant work ethic. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's very good that we work hard and provide for our family. But often what the Protestant work ethic does is it says you're only a virtuous person if you're always working. Mm-hmm. And what you get are these very traditional families, but the father's working so much he never sees his family. And we often make fun of like the French and German that they'll take like a month off in the summer, but maybe we need to do that. Maybe it's weird because in one sense Americans are lazy, but in another sense we work too much. Mm-hmm. We need leisure. I don't know if you've told your listeners about a great book by Joseph Pieper called Leisure as the Basis of Culture. That's Pieper because it's spelled P-E-I-P-E-R. Looks like Piper, but it's really Pieper in German. And he shows how, you know, all of culture comes out of leisure. And leisure is not the same thing as laziness. Leisure is taking the time to stop, to shut off the social media, to just listen and interact and contemplate and meditate. And we just don't take that time. When I was a kid, I grew up in the 70s, I hated how people always had the TV on in the background. It's like they needed endless white noise because they never wanted to think about anything. And again, what you're talking about, the loving care you take in your microbrewery, is the kind of care that is, in an ultimate way, it's actually meditative, right? You're stopping and I just think of all those monks that they, you know, that made wine in their monasteries, right? There's a, you know, what they call the cow of beer making, right? Like the Zen of the art of motorcycle making, right? Zen. It's the Zen of beer making, right?
Yeah.
And again, this is that same idea that some Christians, Zen. Well, that's Buddhist. That's the end. No, okay. The idea of slowing down and meditating is just a technique.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that technique in any way. You can use it to, you know, praise yourself, or you can use it to praise God, or you can use it to praise pagan gods or whatever. But as a technique of, you know, it's just like, I don't know, it's like, do people even do hobbies anymore? Do people actually build ships anymore? I mean, bottle ships.
Right. Well, for this podcast, there's a whole bunch of home brewers and home winemakers and even cheese makers. This audience is probably, as far as hobbies go, probably the extreme. As far as the home brewing can take over, like for me, I haven't even done it in a while, but I've got 4 cabinets full of homebrew gear and a closet and another laundry room, and it's everywhere. It starts to take over your entire house because it's just, you know, you start with one. It's like, all right, let's see if I can do it. And then it's like, all right, let's see if I can do another one. And then you start trying to perfect. And then it becomes, you know, just this obsession on, you know, where else can I go with this?
So. It is, but you know, these things are a kind of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And we need it. Just like, you know, there are some Christians, you know, I mean, of course, you know, with very few exceptions, most Christians think of sort of Sunday as the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
But in the old days, sometimes they were too legalistic about the Sabbath. You know, no laughing on the Sabbath. But I think we're starting to see families that are recognizing the importance of that slowing down, that leisure on Sunday, but rather than make it sort of anti-human, only don't do this, let's make it something human and familiar. I'll give you an example. I've spoken a lot for a group called the Seventh-day Adventists.
Mm.
And they're Christians, but they can be a little bit legalistic. And they're really, really big on the Sabbath on Saturday, of doing nothing on the Sabbath. And some of them can be pretty legalistic. But I became very good friends with the family. They were students of mine. And I always remembered what they told me when they were growing up. The way their parents treated the Sabbath was as a special day. And so when they were kids, there were only certain toys they could play with on the Sabbath.
Hmm.
They had special play clothes that they only wore on the Sabbath. So you see what you're doing? Now you're taking something that, you know, the Pharisees at the time of Jesus were using for legalistic reasons to shut down joy. They were using it as a way of showing students, of their kids,
hmm,
that there is such a thing as the special, the sacred, that, you know, I mean, I've seen this not only in the growing interest in the making of wine and the making of beer and you know, pipes and pipe weed like Tolkien. I'm also seeing it. I'm of the generation that, you know, grew up. I grew up Greek Orthodox, and then the Lord moved me into the evangelical world. But I've got a growing number of students that grew up evangelical and are finding themselves becoming Catholic or Orthodox or High Anglican.
Hmm.
And it's because, there's many reasons, but one of the reasons is, they're hungry for liturgy, for the sacred, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know it sounds strange to compare, you know, a Catholic mass with the brewing of beer, but there is a similarity. That there's a, again, stop, listen, look at how even the most ordinary things can bear divine meaning because Christ became man, right? Because God became man in Christ. And so all of this is part of a movement. I think if there's a common core that links it all together, it's a desire for liturgy, for the sacred year, for the idea of feasts and festivals, for Mardi Gras, but Mardi Gras linked to Lent because there's a time, you know, we were talking before about Flashdance. Footloose,
yeah,
right? Remember, and they turned that into a musical too, which I got to see at the Miller Outdoor Theater here in Houston. I don't know if you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
They put it on free in the outdoor theater. But the climax is when he reads Ecclesiastes, right? There's a time to mourn, but there's also a time to dance.
Yes.
There's a time for all things under the sun. And I think we've lost. I mean, talk to our grandparents. Back in the days when there were certain fruits and vegetables you could only get in a brief period of time.
Yes.
And how much special. Now we could get almost anything we want at almost any time. We've lost the sense of the sacred year, of being part of a cycle of, this is the time. So we could be like one of those Jane Austen novels where everybody goes out and picks strawberries, right?
Yeah.
There's only a few months of the year, a few weeks of the year that you could do that. But we've tried to take ourselves out of the cycle and have everything we want now. I want an Oompa Loompa, and I want it now. Okay, that's what we want. We don't want to be patient. And I guess maybe when it comes to brewing, it's an art. It's a craft. It can't be rushed.
Well, and that's, you know? If you get into home brewing and you like join the Home Brewers Association, they'll send out a brewer's calendar. There's certain styles that you brew now to drink later. So like an Oktoberfest was brewed back in March and then lagered until, you know, now. You know, and that's traditionally was the the beer to celebrate the royal wedding of Prince Ludwig and Princess Teresa in Bavaria, I think. Or
Cool.
No, not Bavaria. It would be wherever, somewhere in
Austria. Austria, maybe Austria-Hungary.
Somewhere it's German, but it's somewhere around there. But that was back in early 1800s, and it's become the Oktoberfest party out in Munich. That's where it was. That's where Oktoberfest Munich. That started as a wedding feast, and every year they brewed that beer that style specifically for, and it really does. It's a malty lager that is crisp and goes with roast meat and all the things that you're harvesting at the time. There's like Bock. Bock beer is for the spring. It's very much an Easter time beer, and it's brewed in the winter, and it has to lager over the winter. There's the brewing calendar really does make you anticipate different times of the year, and you really do have to put in the time if you care to do that. There are styles, obviously, that you can drink all year round and that sort of thing. And the weather here in Houston is hot. We have like Houston summer, and then like 3 weeks of fall, and then back to summer. And
yeah, that's right.
But
somebody said Houston has 8 months of summer and 4 months of indecision.
Yes.
That's basically what we have. Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you go to a place that actually has seasons, and then you look at the brewing throughout the year, it very much, follows the calendar, the seasonal beers and everything like that too. So, I don't know.
Do you follow the more European model then of drinking your beer at room temperature rather than cold?
Well, it's never been at room temperature. So that's a common misconception. It's cellar temperature.
Oh, really?
So
what should it be?
Well, depending on the style, different styles have different temperatures. We can get super. I want you to get super nerdy about Tolkien here in a second, because this is where I really wanted to tie it in.
Oh, yeah.
So I'll get a little nerdy about beer real quick. But yeah, certain styles like English ales, like a porter or a stout, are served at what we call cellar temperature. So they were put in the cellar down below where they can actually have a basement in some places, I've heard. And so they would put, and it'd be about 55 degrees. But something like a crisp German lager, like a Pilsner, that's going to be more around 40. 40, 37, something like that, but not so ice cold you can't taste it. Your taste buds can only do so much loo. And then that's why they serve cheap beer super cold, so you can't taste it. And you've had enough of it to where you're like, I don't even know what that was, but they've already got your money. So
as long as you drink the water cold enough, Houston water is going to taste good. Right.
Right. Really exactly.
You won't know the difference, right?
Yes. But one thing I wanted to tie into is, so I've listening to your conversation with Michael Heiser, Dr. Heiser, it was fascinating. You were talking about Lord of the Rings, and you're a Lord of the Rings expert. You teach a class.
Usually every 2 or 3 years at least. I teach one, sometimes every other year, class of Lord of the Rings.
And, when you watch those movies, and we were talking about this the other day, a friend of mine, we were going over a single beer in one of our required drinking episodes, and it was a beer that's very prominent now, one of the biggest IPAs in America, Dogfish Head 60-Minute IPA. It came out in 2003, and Return of the King came out in 2003. We're kind of going through that year and what was going on and that sort of thing. And, those movies, I'll watch them at least once a year. I had a COVID scare, a false positive, but I still had to quarantine for the 2 weeks all by myself. Yep. So the first thing I did was watch all three of the Hobbit movies, the extended editions, and then all three of Lord of the Rings extended editions. And, that was kind of like
a religious experience.
Yes. It was like
at least 7 or 8 times I've hosted a party at my house, usually on New Year's Eve, sometimes 4th of July Eve. And we'll watch the entire trilogy, the full version, at 12 hours, and it is quite an experience. You have to do it as a group together, have lots of snacks, and
Have you ever done? So I have a friend. When we were talking about Return of the King, my friend Keenan, he was talking about watching the movie, but then also doing the Hobbit meals. So you start with breakfast, and then second breakfast, and then luncheon.
Right, yep.
And he's like, it's like seven meals throughout the day, and you might not even want to eat.
11 teas, all this stuff. Yeah,
yeah. And so it's like, you know, eventually it's like you're so full, but it's a fun experience to kind of do.
Yeah.
But when I watch those movies, the whole story, and when I've read the books as well, although it's been a while, and just like you said, I started the Silmarillion, but I never finished it. Just like you said.
Oh, you're right. It does happen. People say that all the time.
But I'm going to read it, and I'm going to finish it. I promise you. So I'll get that assignment in, I promise. But the that whole story really starts in the pub. The one in the Shire, is that the Green Dragon?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Shire.
In the Shire, it's the Green Dragon. That's kind of where everything starts. And then the action really picks up in Bree at the Prancing Pony. Same thing with in The Hobbit. You know, they flash back to, in the movie, Gandalf and Thorin talking.
Yes, and you know, that was not completely invented. That's in one of the appendices of The Lord of the Rings, actually mentions that meeting.
Really?
I had to go back and look for it again myself. So they just, you know, I like how it begins there. Hmm. So is your favorite line from the movie pipes?
Yes.
It comes in pipes?
Yeah. And I would imagine, you know, for a Hobbit, you know, that pint was huge, right?
No, that's right. That's the idea.
But it was, pints, you know, that scene in the Green Dragon where everybody, you know, they're bringing in the big pumpkin. I'm a big pumpkin fan too. This time of year I get giddy.
Really?
Yeah. I probably spend too much. Like every time I go to the grocery store, I come home with another pumpkin. So my wife's like, you can't, you got to stop. But it's that scene. There's something in that scene that really speaks to me. Just the jovial nature of everything, and just you know, all of that. You see them just talking about whatever, and then they're talking about strange folk around, and that's where everything starts to turn. And then I was, you know, before we started this interview, I was like, I knew I wanted to talk to you because I was fascinated so much with your conversation with Dr. Heiser and the other things I've seen of yours on your YouTube channel. Everybody go check it out. I'll put a link in the description. But I was like, how do I tie in the talk of beer with Tolkien other than, yes, they do drink beer in the movie, but...
Well, I mean, seriously, the way to tie it in, and you know, a lot of people complain, why is the beginning so long? You know, at the Shire. And of course, it's very long in the book, too. So it's very faithful to the book. And I am so glad. I love those opening sections and the music. And part of the reason the music's so beautiful, da 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 dee, da da, he's stolen that from the great hymn, This Is My Father's World, which just sort of fits together in that. But the reason we have to spend so much in the Shire is because we need to understand that this is what we're fighting for. If Frodo is going to give his life, what is he giving it for? Mm-hmm. He's not giving it for wealth or riches or power. He's giving it so that a bunch of friends can meet in the pub over a pint. Mm-hmm. And C.S. Lewis talks about this a lot, of course, was best friends with Tolkien. Mm-hmm. This is why we do things. This is what we're fighting for. Right? We're fighting so people can have the freedom to just have those simple joys and simple pleasures and simple camaraderie. And you know that Tolkien is a super purist, right? But notice that he cannot resist giving his Shire potatoes and tobacco, right? Uh-huh. Now, potatoes and tobacco come from the New World, okay? Mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings is supposed to be the earth, but like even before God spoke to Abraham, so a long time ago, right? So, in other words, he messes with his geography just so, because he's, you know, as important as the beer is the pipe weed. Okay, yes. They sort of go together, don't they? Uh-huh. But you know, all of those things are, you know, you love that wonderful thing that the hobbits love a simple life, right? Mm-hmm. And just good tilled earth. I mean, the way you started this podcast, when you talked about, you know, the smell and the feel, you know, of the hops, of the brewery, of all that you're doing, it's that same sensation of closeness. They love good, tilled earth. Man, I suffer from hay fever. That still makes me want to go out and live there anyway, even though I would die from my allergies. When I read that, I think, oh, my gosh, this is what we're fighting for. We're fighting for people to have that kind of pub camaraderie in the pub. And I'm sure this really influenced you, the difference between the typical American bar mm-hmm. and the typical British pub is so different. The bar is a place often to escape from your family. The pub is a place to enhance fellowship, right? Mm-hmm. Have you become a dart player?
A little bit.
Josh?
Yeah, a little bit. Cornhole, it's usually more readily available. Even like at St. Arnold, they have the bocce ball courts.
There we go.
Those are a lot of fun, too.
But, I mean, these are the simple things. You know, C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Problem of Pain, and he's like, you know, that super settled joy that we all look for, it is not given to us, right? This world is not my home. Right? We're not given that absolute stability we want. And yet, Lewis says, God has scattered those little joys broadcast, right? A merry meeting with our friends, a trip to the pub, a football game, a bath, all of these different things. It's these little pleasures that give life so much meaning. And again, the hobbits are not perfect. They're rather xenophobic. They can be rather petty and things like that. But they know the goodness of just the food, the beer, the pipeweed, the family, all of those simple pleasures they've absorbed. And they've got a good life. And we've forgotten, I think, those simple pleasures.
Yeah,
and I'm glad that the movies were made by Australians and New Zealanders, because I think they understand that better than we do. I'll tell you something else they understand in Australia and New Zealand. They understand what true male friendship is. I am so thankful that those movies were not made in America, because if they made those movies in America, they never would have allowed Frodo and Sam to be so close, even though that's the absolute heart of the movies and the novel, is because everybody would think they're gay or something. Mm. But that's our problem. We've forgotten what male friendship is and how important it is. I think that's why guys love watching things about Vikings and all. It's not like they want to go out and kill people, but they miss a sort of, you know, real, essential male friendship, a joy over these things. It's not gay in any way. Mm-hmm. But we've just sickened so many things in our country. We don't understand just those little pleasures, the little joys that make people and make our lives fuller and richer. And we've lost that. And I think we're losing it more in this crazy society.
Yeah, I do think it speaks to, and I know you mentioned maybe it's your interview with Hank Hanegraaff. You mentioned the Renaissance Festival, which just started.
Yes. Oh, and yeah. And you know, this just with the COVID, I didn't get my tickets this year. I thought, oh, I'm going to wait, because I go every year. I love the Renaissance Festival. And what always amazes me is, and it took me a while to realize this, I always used to go, and then one day I started looking around and I realized, you know, 75% of the people here, we would disagree about everything from politics to religion to sexuality to marriage. I mean, a lot of the people that go to the Renaissance Festival would actually say they hate everything the Middle Ages stands for, and yet they're there. Mm-hmm. Because I think we're hungry for a world like that, a world of hierarchy, a world with that different, a world where masculine and feminine are pretty easy to tell, mm-hmm. okay? I could tell that bar wench over there, that's definitely a woman, okay? And that man over there, even though he's wearing a skirt, because he's a Scotsman, that's a man, right? I really do think people in our country especially are hungry for that. It is tied up with the pipe, how many people at the Renaissance Festival, have you bought yourself a flagon, you know, the one that looks like a ram's horn that you drink out of?
Right.
You have one of those now?
I may have one around here somewhere, if I'm honest.
But again, there's just something about it. And, you know, and so that, okay, I want my pipe, but I want a, you know, handmade pipe made out of the finest wood. I mean, it's the same thing. We're looking for craft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I teach at Houston Baptist University, a liberal arts college. I think the best thing that could happen in our country, if we brought back actual real vocational schools. Mm. Let vocational schools be vocational and let liberal arts schools be liberal arts. Because I really believe we should, and some homeschoolers are slowly doing this. A liberal arts education is not for everyone, especially between the ages of 18 and 21. And I'm just very slowly seeing a return of the idea of apprenticeship, being an apprentice
yes.
to a carpenter, to a plumber, to a metal worker, or to a brewer. right? Yeah. Or to a winemaker.
That's the way that industry goes. To me, when I look at the craft beer movement, it really did start that way because, you know, the first craft brewery in America was, I guess you could say, was Anchor Steam or Anchor, the Anchor Brewing out in San Francisco in the early 80s or late 70s, which that actually, I say that, that's when Fritz Maytag bought it. But Sierra Nevada in 83, I believe, is when that one, you know, started. He had to build all his own equipment out of old dairy equipment because there just wasn't anything around, and everything's kind of evolved from there. You know, here we are 40 years later, and it really is. You look at the different breweries around town here in Houston and across Texas, people have worked at one, they've moved to the other, they've gone to open their own, and it really is has been an apprenticeship type relationship. There are some people that go get the formal education, but the vast majority is more of an apprenticeship approach.
That's how we learn. And, you know, there's been a growing number, especially the evangelists. Let's go out and have a farm, have a sheep farm or something.
Yeah.
What's that guy's name? Walker Percy. Mm. Not Walker Percy, Wendell Berry. You know, again, an agrarianism. Because look, okay, what conservative used to mean, okay, not the same thing as Republican, okay? A true conservative, the kind of people making this beer, yes, they're suspicious of big government, as they should be, mm-hmm. but they're also suspicious of big business. Mm-hmm. When the business gets so big, it loses the human element. That's a problem as well.
Yeah.
Right? And real conservatives believe in private property, but again, not so one person can own it. They believe that everybody needs some property of their own. Mm. They need to have that self-sufficiency, that investment in land that is their own. Terra, you know, the end of Gone with the Wind. Everything's gone except the land. And then she suddenly realizes for the first time the closeness to the land is one of the things that we identify with. Mm. Right? And you know, that's something that I think is understood. I lived half my life in the North and half in the South. And one thing that the South has is that understanding. I really believe that, you know, it all goes together with the cheap beer, okay? You know, the big recession we had 10 years ago, not the COVID, but the one 10 years ago, mm-hmm. was partly because of a, what do they call that, real estate bubble. And I really think that the problem wasn't just the banks and all the crooked things they were doing. I think all of that problem started when people stopped thinking of their house as a home and started thinking of it as an investment.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we're no longer thinking of this as our home, our nest, something for our family. We're just thinking of it as disposable cash and a disposable investment. And I think when we changed our view, it goes together with all the stuff we've been talking this last hour. We've lost a sense of the small, the close, the familial, the intimate link between the two, you know, all of that. I think is coming back in different ways, and mm-hmm. I do think that. You know, the brewing is part of that. It's part of an extension of your home. I'm a very conservative person, right? So I'm very supportive of the idea of the husband working and the housewife and all. But you know what? That idea, as we see it, is actually very recent. It only goes back to the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. It used to be we all lived and worked side by side, husband, wife, and kids, on some kind of a farm. Or whether we're making them. I have relatives still in Greece. My grandparents are all from Greece, in Sparta, and they live on a farm, but what they raise on the farm is not the chickens and goats, it's oranges and olive trees, right? So there's different things that you farm, but we've lost that, the time of, I'm teaching the Odyssey, and I just taught my students the word oikos, O-I-K-O-S. Now, they all know that word because it's a kind of yogurt from Greece now, but oikos is the root of our word economy and economics, and oikos means the home, but the home as an economic unit, so that you're working, but your wife is doing what the Proverbs 31 wife is doing. She's working at the loom. She's making clothes. And if she's a richer wife, that she's got serving ladies under her also working. They might be making wine. They might be making beer. But it's the family as that kind of a unit where everybody has a role in that family unit. Now our kids, the only role they seem to have is consumer. That seems to be mm-hmm. the role that they have.
Mm-hmm.
They've lost a sense, right? Chores is not just a way to work your kids. That chores means bringing your children into the family unit and understanding their role within that. And then everybody knows who they are and what they do. and they feel much more a part of something.
Yes.
So you see, all of this is part of a wider movement that I think is good.
Yes. It's interesting, as I followed the craft beer movement, it was very much the little guys versus the big guys. So when it first,
It
was
David and Goliath.
Yes. It was very much the local small craft brewer versus the macro giant. And like, we're not going to do what they do. We're going to do this locally and we're going to know our neighbors and all that kind of stuff. And there's been, as it's got this, we're 20 years into it now. I almost feel like the kids coming up, and I say kids, 21 years old now, they've always had all this amazing local beer around. And it's the story of what these guys had to do. When you talk to Brock Wagner, who's the founder of St. Arnold, when you talk to what he had to do to get that going, and all these other, the local brewers around here, what they had to do. And now the challenges with COVID, but even so, at the beginning, I think it may be lost on some the younger generation, the 21 year olds now, and it's just kind of what it is. And so these stories have to be told. And I wonder if, how do you convey that message so that it's not lost? And then we don't get back to where we were, 20 years ago.
Yeah. And it's got to be a lived reality somehow. They need to see how it works. I mean, what we were saying before about the year, the sacred year, everybody used to follow the, old farmer's almanac and stuff like that to make them. Okay. It's really funny. Americans, we get together with our family every Thanksgiving, right? We have a big dinner. And, each year we discuss things. But you know what? If you were to tape record your entire Thanksgiving conversation, and then the next year you had a conversation, and then you played the tape, you would probably find that your conversation was almost exactly the same. You didn't intend it to be. Uh-huh. But we shouldn't be embarrassed by that, right? We are a people that take to that kind of ritual. Right, just like if we sang Christmas carols all year round, they wouldn't be as special.
Right.
But the Christmas carols are wonderful; they're part of that celebration. And again, it's what you said. We need to appeal to all of the senses, right? So it's not just the eye; it's the ear, it's the nose, it's the touch, right? All of the senses are being appealed to, the taste, and that goes together in a celebration of Christmas or Advent or Lent or Easter, whatever it happens to be. I mean, those old calendars had all, the saint days and all the feasts and things there. Mm-hmm. And they were usually tied to the seasonal cycle in one way or another. And it's beautiful. I mean, the only place we have that now is if you're a teacher.
Yeah.
You still have an understanding of that year and the need for leisure and the need for work, and the balance between the two and the family being part of it, all of that stuff. And you don't have to spend a fortune. When my kids were growing up, we took them to all the national parks all around the country, long car trips. And as we took car trips, we listened to Focus on the Family radio play versions of The Chronicles of Narnia. We listened to the BBC radio play version of The Lord of the Rings. Mm. And we enjoyed this great country with all of the sights and smells and tastes and touches and all of that stuff. Slow down and appreciate that beauty. And again, it's like watching The Lord of the Rings. I mean, that's part of my family. We talk to each other in terms of The Lord of the Rings half the time, just love those movies. It's scary. Sometimes my lovely daughter will suddenly say, "All right, boys, look like beats back on the menu." She just licks her lip with her. What the heck? But all of it is like I said, they've done enough of those marathons. So they've been at all the parties. If you had to
identify with one character from Lord of the Rings or just the greater, Middle Earth Tolkien universe, is there one that you identify with more than any other?
I mean, I love them all, but I am a professor, so I've got to be a little bit of a Gandalf, the guide, the professor, and I love how they make him so real, right?
Uh-huh.
In what sense he's, this jolly guy, but he's also the one who says, "Fly, you fools!
Yes.
Fool of a toque, throw yourself in next time." he is sometimes a crotchety professor, basically, right? And other times he's so supportive. But, I will tell you, what this generation is looking for is not so much a preacher. They're looking for a Gandalf, a life guide that will help them understand how do you live life? How do you live life to the full and be a full and real person? And we need more Gandalfs or Dumbledores or whatever. You know, we need that the wise guy, the Obi-Wan Kenobi, the sensei. You know, if a lot of people do the martial arts, not so much because they really think they're going to beat up a crook, but they need that sensei, that guide, right? Mm-hmm. The wise old man that leads you along. Again, people are hungry for it. They need role models again. They need the apprenticeship program of a person who not only teaches you a trade, a craft, but a person who teaches you about life. And I teach the great epics all the time, Iliad, Odyssey, Aeneid, Inferno. And when I teach it, I try to teach it in terms of heroes. What does it mean to be a hero? You know, people ask, what would Jesus do? And I said, that's good, but I want you to ask, what would Achilles do? Mm. What would Odysseus do? What would Aeneas do? Right? What would they do? What does it mean to be a hero? Because they want to be a hero. I mean, you see it. They're desperate with all the Marvel superhero movies. The superheroes have basically saved Hollywood. They've almost saved TV too.
Right.
But it's because we're hungry for someone. We need to go back to the old days when they had Roy Rogers, who taught kids to live by a code.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What does it mean to be the cowboy? What does it mean to live by a code? And I think people want that again. But it's got to be linked to joy.
Yes.
A joy of life, a participation in the cycles of life.
Mm.
And, you know, this is my idea. You know, there's a certain beer for a certain day.
Yes.
Just like, I had a crazy coach when I was in high school. You know, God made different sports for different seasons, right? I mean, it's the way it is. But there is some truth to that.
Yes. The sports calendar this year has really shown that, you know, we're football mode now. That's when nobody wants to watch, you know, NBA. The ratings have been horrible.
That's true. That's a good point. You're right.
And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's, you know, there are certain sports and certain events and certain styles of beer and certain meals and certain, you know, all of that for the certain times of year. And nobody wants to hear, you know, Christmas music in March or April.
Right.
You know, it's
just not right. It loses its specialness and its sacredness and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When I taught my kids about the birds and the bees, and I wanted to teach them, you know, why sex is for marriage, I taught them in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
I took them over to the china closet. We opened it up, and I said, "What's in there?" They said, "Oh, that's our fine china, our fine dishes." And I said, "Oh, do we use those dishes every day? You know, do we eat pizza off them?" He said, "No, we just use them, you know, for Thanksgiving and Christmas, right?" Well, why do we do that? Are we embarrassed by these plates? Do we think that they're unworthy or unclean? No, it's because they're special. I'm trying to move towards the reason that sex is for marriage is not because sex is dirty and unclean. It's because it's something special and sacred and is meant for a certain time and place.
Yes.
And it really worked. Now, I'm afraid, Josh, I'm afraid that, you know, 5 years from now, my daughter-in-law is going to come to me and say, "What did you teach your son? We only have sex on Thanksgiving and Christmas." That's my fear. But it's understanding. And I will tell you what I told my kids. I said, you know, when you reach the right age, if you want to drink, you can. But I want your first drink to be here at home, not in some smoky bar.
Right.
I want you to, you know, so now they do. They'll drink a glass of wine sometimes, whatnot. But they've understood the specialness of it, right? And not, I mean, there's far less problems with alcoholism in France because the kids learn to drink at home and to respect the wine, more wine than beer, I guess, in France, in its proper place. But here, by demonizing it, we make it into something, what do I want to say, adventurous and whatnot, and we end up having more alcoholics in America than we do in a place where the kids grow up drinking it.
Yes.
So we need to respect things. Somebody told me that people are starting to be mauled by wild animals again because Disney has so domesticated these animals that we've lost our proper fear of bears, lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. And apparently mauling is on the rise.
Yeah.
Because we've lost a proper sense of respect and awe for wild animals.
Yeah, I have a sneaking suspicion the bears may be behind a lot of things just to lull us into a false sense of security. I can't prove it yet, Lou. It's just a theory. It's a working theory.
I like that.
But yeah, you know, I've already decreed to my girls. I said, when you are 20, we're going to brew beer that will be your first beer.
good, exactly.
And so
this is something you did and experienced at home.
Yes.
And so it has to be in the proper environment.
Yes. And people make, my friends make fun of me because I do ritualize, you know, the beer drink. It's like you get the proper glass and you get it at the proper temperature and you pour it and you let it aerate and, you know, but all of that. And then you smell it. You don't just go right at it. You know, you smell
right.
it, and you don't just stick your nose in there. You want to, circle it around and get the proper, you know, those aromatics come off at different times and at different temperatures. And,
right.
You know, if you really want to experience it all.
It's like the tea culture in China.
Yes.
It's a tea culture.
Yeah.
There's a ritual way to do it.
Yes.
Just slop it in there, you know?
It just makes it so much more enjoyable because, I mean, we're given a limited amount of time on this earth that God gave us and, you know, just step back a moment and enjoy it and take it all in and don't rush it.
Don't rush it. Oh, I hate when I see kids barreling down their food.
Yeah.
This is why I get mad when churches decide to have something on Wednesday night at 6 o'clock. I said, why 6 o'clock? Mm-hmm. If you want everybody there at 6 o'clock, that means that your families are going through the drive-through line in McDonald's and wolfing it down. No, make it at 7. I know it's later, but and I always said, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to sacrifice a proper meal with my family to rush off to a church event.
Yeah.
No, there's a dissonance there for me. There's a cognitive dissonance there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Food is to be appreciated. So is your wife as excited about this as your kids?
She's excited that I'm excited.
Okay, good.
She
recognizes this as good, you know, daddy time with the kids.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. And she, you know, she is not, she's more, what would I say? She's more of a
tea person or a coffee person?
See, that's another obsession is coffee in the morning, the ritual in the morning and the ritual late in the day. The one that gets you started and the one to wind things down.
What age did you let your kids drink coffee?
You know, they don't drink it all the time now. They're, you know, they'll sip it if I do like, I was a barista for a minute, you know, just for a short time.
Oh, okay.
And that's when I started to appreciate, I didn't even like coffee when I started. They just made me go over there because I wasn't very good at book sales. It was in a bookstore. And, but I was really good at talking to people. And, so then I started to appreciate the smells and everything like that. So I'll do like, like the Cuban style coffee with butter and sugar and things like that. Every once in a while, they'll enjoy that, a little bit, you know, just a few sips here and there.
Cause I mean, one of the big changes when I was a kid, coffee was as much an adult drink as wine.
Yeah.
You didn't see kids drinking coffee. And now these kids, I mean, they start the day with a frappuccino, which basically means half caffeine and half sugar.
Right.
And these kids are in middle school. They've got the jitters. And you probably know that messes with your brain.
Yes.
Drinking that much caffeine and sugar rewires your brain.
Uh-huh.
And so, again, it's really disturbing when I see it. They need to understand a proper respect for all of these things.
Yeah. And grind.
Again, because it's commercialized.
Right. And grind your own beans.
Wow, there we go.
I mean, that's it, as far as, you know, really enjoying it, just to know, just the sound and the it makes you slow down. All of that, right? We need a break. Like, not
you,
a break.
You haven't started grinding your own wheat, have you? I know at least one homeschool family that actually she grinds her own wheat, you know, raw wheat.
Not yet. I'm looking to buy a big rock, though.
There we go. Get a millstone or something.
Yeah.
And what about learning to bottle your own, what do you call those things? Pickles and stuff. Pickling things.
You know, my grandmother did pickles and...
She did, well.
Yes. And I love...
Or jams.
Yeah, she did all of that. Yeah, she's from deep in the heart of Mississippi and just an old Southern belle. And she... maybe that's part of it, you know? Maybe it's in the DNA. I don't know, but
This might be the new pickling.
Yes. I love a good pickle.
The making of preserves.
Yes. It's,
you know, all of this, of course, was because we didn't have refrigeration. We needed to do these things.
Yes. And that was a big part of beer, too. Like, you go back and look at history, we needed it. We wouldn't have been here without it. The water wasn't fit to drink. You needed fermentation just a little bit to take, you know, they didn't know boiling killed off all the bad stuff. So
that's true. And the old joke about I only drink for medicinal purposes, there was actually quite a bit of truth to that.
Yes. Yes.
So if you could go back and change the Bible, would you change it from take a little beer for your stomach instead of wine for your stomach?
you know, I, I'm You know, all due respect to the Almighty. No, I would not, Lou, I would not change a thing about the Bible, but if they had mentioned beer somewhere in there, I would, you know, it would make things easier.
Is beer mentioned in the Bible? I'm trying to think about it.
They mentioned strong drink. There's the,
Strong drink, okay.
You know, in the Old Testament, they mention, the grain offerings and they mention, wine, you know, the wine offerings as well. Right. So, I don't think there's an, it's not an explicit mention of beer as much as I want there to be, but
yeah.
There is some archaeology I think that points to, you know, at least the Israelites when they were in Egypt and that era there, it was around
the beer with them.
Yeah, it was
so
around.
That was one of the treasures they despoiled the Egyptians. They took their beer.
Yes.
They took their beer brewing techniques.
Yes. There you go. So, well,
I don't want
to take too much.
It's a great conversation. That's right. You got to get off too. It's a good conversation.
Yes, and I'd love to have another one sometime down the road. Maybe when the new book comes out, if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay,
that'd be great.
And
like I said, I'm going to be doing one. Maybe after I do my interview with Dr. Heiser, maybe we'll do one.
Okay,
listen to it and like it. That would be great.
Absolutely, so, and you know, once all this COVID, once we're able to get back to a little bit of norm. You know, again, if you end up going to the RenFest this year or next year, I know the head brewer, the brewmaster at Brigadoon Brewery, which is a brewery out there. Yeah, Alan, he's a good friend of mine. And, you know, they do demonstrations on old world brewing styles and stuff like that. So let me know and I'll let him know you're coming and
he can
show you around. He's a great guy. But Lou, thank you so much. This has been a whole lot of fun. And
thanks. Great conversation. And hold in there. And remember, it comes in pints.
Yeah, yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Take care.
This is Interbrews.
The preceding has been a presentation of Stewed Productions.